So again, I would like to also thank the organizers for asking me to speak here today. I'll be mainly talking about stellar magnetic field measurements. As people have talked about what is required of any complete dynamo theory earlier today, and I would say that any complete dynamo theory must also then be able to apply to other stars and explain the observations that we see on other stars. And I'm hoping that some of the things that we have learned from other stars can apply lessons to the Sun. Traditionally, we've gone the other way. We've been trying to apply a solar paradigm to interpret virtually all that we see from other stars, and that gets us in trouble sometimes, and so I hope to point out some of that. Even though I will be talking about stellar magnetic field measurements, I'll be focusing mainly on cool star measurements, but I do want to point out that there are magnetic fields on hotter stars, A and B stars, the peculiar stars, and they have whopping big fields. The record is Babcock star. Here you see the spectra of H alpha taken through a right and left circular polarizer, and we have a 34 kilogauss field here that is shows a strong polarity. Here's the V signal. And this is sort of 34 kilogauss is not typical of AP and BP stars, but they all show very strong dipole components to their fields. They're not perfect dipoles. Some of them are off-center and some of them have quadrupolar components, but they are generally dipolar. And one of the questions is, what is the origin of these fields? Now, these stars did have convective paths when they were young, but as they've evolved now onto the main sequence, they're sitting there with radiative outer zones. Some of them are radiative throughout. Some of them do have convective cores, and people have talked about interface dynamos between the radiative outer zone and that convective inner core. So you get sort of the general idea of a dynamo operating in a solar tachocline, but for these stars, they always produce dipolar fields by the time they reach the surface. another thing that people have talked about, maybe these fields are just primordial, they're left over from the formation of these objects. That's pretty much all I'm going to say about AP stars. When we talk about cool stars, one thing that has sort of become a staple of cool star science is this rotation activity diagram. Shown on the x-axis here is basically the log of the inverse Rossby number, which is the convective turnover time divided by the rotation period, which is related to the dynamo number, the strength of dynamo. And shown on this axis is a measure of the chromospheric emission seen in the calcium H and K lines. Or shown on this axis is an X-ray, the log of the X-ray luminosity over the bolometric luminosity. And there's a pretty good correlation between the chromospheric indice and the X-ray indices. And so not all these points, some of these points are actually calcium measurements, some of them are X-ray measurements, and they get put into this, can be put into this joint diagram. And what you see that as the rotation rate increases, so the rotation period goes down, the activity as traced by these emissions goes up to some saturation level. Above that level, the points, the stars don't continue to show increases in activity, even though they may be rotating even faster or have even longer convective turnover times. And the question then arises, is this due to the fact that maybe the star is full of magnetic flux, or is this a limit to the dynamo? How efficiently can the dynamo operate? And one of the things that we hope to do with measurements of stellar magnetic fields is to separate those problems, because you have sort of the combined problems of coronal or chromospheric heating and then the dynamo problem of generating magnetic fields. And we'd like to put limits on what the actual fields are. Just to connect the idea of magnetic flux in X-rays, I show briefly this plot showing the magnetic flux from various solar features, as well as G and K stars, and actually T Tauri stars and young stars. And there does seem to be a very good correlation over many orders of magnitude between the overall magnetic flux of a feature or a star or whatever it is, and the amount of X-rays that it produces in presumably its corona or the associated corona. Of course, on the Sun, we have exquisite measurements, for one of the things, because it is so close and we can resolve the surface. And when we go to stars, of course, we can't do that, so we have to sometimes look for other proxies. But one of the things that the Sun shows is this cyclical behavior of the magnetic activity that has been talked about in all of the previous talks. And we do see evidence for that type of behavior on other stars. And this is all data from the Mount Wilson H&K project, headed by Sally Baliunas and her collaborators. And they've monitored a little over 100 stars now over a long period, about 30 years, and monitoring their calcium H&K emission. And what you can see is that for a number of the stars, they show apparently periodic or somewhat periodic variations in the strength of their calcium emission, with periods ranging from, presumably cycle periods ranging from a few years up to 20 years or so. Some of the, and there's about half of the sample that they've looked at show this cyclic behavior, this activity cycles. Some of the trends that have come out of this study is that young stars, only a few, couple billion years old, these are all F, G, and K stars, they aren't M stars. The younger stars in their sample typically show high levels of activity, so they show lots of calcium emission, and they typically show very stochastic activity. They don't show periods. As you get into middle-aged stars, you begin to see lower levels of activity and the appearance of cycle periods and the occasional appearance of maunder minima, things that we would associate with the maunder minima in the Sun, where you see virtually no activity and then the star will come out of that, or you'll see a star with some activity then go into a maunder minima. And as stars get even older, their activity levels drops, and they are more likely to show maunder minima cycles. Another thing that's come out of this project is that even though these are averages typically of a few months for these two stars, HD, whatever and whatever, they can measure within a given observing season, so within a given year, they take data on many nights during the year, and they measure the rotation period of these objects. And if you then ask what the rotation period is during times of high activity and times of low activity, if you think of the butterfly diagram on the Sun, there would possibly be a difference in the rotation period if the features were at one latitude or another latitude. This is a way to search for evidence of differential rotation in solar-like stars. And they see clear evidence for that. They see a change in the rotation period with activity cycle on several of their stars. And they also see changes in the solar sense, so that as the activity increases, the rotation period decreases, as if the active regions are migrating towards the equator. They also see the exact opposite behavior. As the activity increases, the rotation periods decrease, as if there's poleward migration. So, and they see these in otherwise identical stars, same spectral type, same temperature, same metallicity. There's no good reason why they should be different. So that's something to keep in mind when you're trying to explain the solar dynamo. There are presumably stars out there that have the same mass of the Sun, same age of the Sun, and they have an opposite butterfly diagram. This was a similar plot to this was shown earlier. Again, this is the magnetic flux in, or the total magnetic flux in regions with field or flux regions higher than 25 Gauss and lower than 25 Gauss. There's a strong variation with the solar cycle in these regions, and there's this sort of background that has a weak dependence, and as Doug Raven showed earlier, there's also perhaps these quiet regions that show absolutely no variation with the solar cycle, and perhaps that is coming from a different type of dynamo, something that's more related to just the turbulent convection itself, and I'll come back to that when we start to talk about magnetic field measurements on M stars, on stars that are completely convective. One of the things that we would like to do, again, when I showed the magnetogram earlier and then in the other talks again, we can resolve the Sun, we can measure those magnetic signals easily. It turns out that particularly for slowly rotating stars, when people have tried to make polarization measurements on other cool stars, they have never seen convincing polarization in an individual spectral line. Just the flux cancellation of the positive and negative polarities produces signals that are way too weak to detect with current techniques. And the question is, well, what would the sun look like if you were to look at it as a star with a polarimeter? And Sergei Plotchinda and collaborators have tried to look at this, and the signal, by taking magnetograms and basically squashing them into one single number, and the signal looks like it's on the order of 2, plus or minus 2 Gauss throughout the solar cycle. And plus or minus 2 Gauss is really at a level that we can't convincingly reach on other stars, even when we look at multi-line techniques. We can get to signals of maybe 10 or so Gauss. This is another plot of that. If you average over several months for several cycles, again showing the behavior now perhaps even down to a fraction of a Gauss. So we're talking about very small signals that you want to look for if you're going to look in polarization measurements on other stars. Now there has been by the same group a potential report that at least on Zaibu A, which is a G8 dwarf, of a single signal with an amplitude of about 30 Gauss, and with the rotation period of the star is about 6 days, and they find when they try and take many observations, actually taken over from different observing seasons and phase them up, they find this potential signal here, again with the strength of a amplitude of about 30 Gauss. But I want to reinforce that these are actually very difficult measurements to make. And when I myself have tried to independently verify some of these results, and I would say the results are ambiguous. This is the level we're trying to push to, but I'm not sure we can convincingly say we're measuring these fields yet. Zaibu A has been looked at 1.6 microns, but not in polarized light, just to look for Zeeman broadening of the spectral lines. And the measurements are in the noise in terms of there's no definite detection. Most of the work, particularly on cool stars that are solar-like and on the main sequence, has been done from measuring Zeeman broadening. And just to reinforce sort of what we do and some of the assumptions that are made, you basically it is assumed that you have a star who has some percentage of its surface that's quiet, that is basically field-free, and there's some line profile associated with that. And then some fraction of the star, in this example we're showing 20% now, that has some field. If it's a very strong field, a simple Zeeman triplet will be split into three components. If it's a weak field, it won't be split into three components. Now, the energy levels are, but once you put in the rotational broadening, the turbulent broadening, all the other things that broaden a stellar spectral line, you would not see the three individual components. And then you add these two together and you get a final profile that looks something like this. If it's a very strong field, you see these obvious shoulders sticking out, and the measurement becomes somewhat easy to make. But if it's a weak field, you get a line profile that's this, that looks very similar to the zero field case, and the job of the observer is to be able to account for the rotation, the turbulent, all the other broadening mechanisms at a sufficient level that they say this line is actually a little bit broader than that line. And the splitting of these Zeeman sigma components is proportional to lambda squared, as well as the Lande G value and the field strength. And so it's this lambda square dependence, as opposed to Doppler mechanisms, which are proportional to lambda, that make you want to go to infrared, to 1.6 or 2 microns, where the Zeeman effect is stronger than your other Doppler broadening mechanisms. On a star with what we believe to be solar-like activity, Epsilon Eri, the best field measurement is this line here, which is a line at 1.6 microns. It's an iron line. The measurements are shown in the dots. And the zero field model is this blue model right here. And you can see it doesn't quite fit the core, and there are these two little areas of the wings where it also doesn't quite match. And so the red profile is the best fitting model, and that model is the parameters that you get out of that are a field strength of about 1.4 kilogauss covering 9% of the stellar surface. It's interesting, this is a measurement made by Jeff Valenti and collaborators, published in 95. Epsilon Aries was a very well-studied star up until that time. This particular observation, as I said, was done in the infrared near 1.6 microns and is actually based on, this is the most magnetically sensitive line, but the entire analysis used approximately 20 lines to measure things like the rotational broadening, the turbulent broadening, whatnot. Previous measurements had often used only two lines, and because of that, and they were working in the optical, and as a result, they didn't really understand their errors. And so it's interesting, if you were to plot the field strength of Epsilon Aries as a function of time, based on observing techniques, the magnetic flux has gone steadily down. It started out with fields of about 1.4 kilogauss covering 50% of the star, and it's gone down from there. I think this is probably a pretty reliable measurement. You can see the signal you're looking for here is pretty weak. One other assumption that we make that's important to note. The relative flux, the continuum flux in these regions, is assumed to be the same. That might not be correct if, for example, the magnetic field is in bright facular regions that are brighter than the quiet sun, or if the magnetic field is primarily coming from cool spot regions that are cooler. And we don't really know the answer when we look at these stars right now, exactly what the structure of the field regions is. And so we assume that they're identical to the quiet atmosphere, just that they have a field in them. And I'll come back to that point in a little bit. This is another case where we've looked now at a zero-age main sequence star. This is a Pleiades star. It's another, it's a K3 Pleiad. This is its roll call number. And so it's very similar in spectral type, presumably in structure, to Epsilon Aries, but it's presumably also younger. This observation was based on approximately 100 or so lines to measure the various stellar parameters, and we derive an effective temperature, a gravity, a metallicity, and a V sine I over here. And we've done that for many lines, and the strongest line in the spectrum here is this iron line at 8468 angstroms, and the measurements shown in the histogram you can see are a little bit broader than the zero field model shown in yellow. The red is again the best fit model, and that fit now is a field of about 2.5 kilogauss covering 50% of the star. So now we're starting to get to numbers that are very big. I should say there's a lot of play in here. You could model this with a field that's say 3 kilogauss, but the filling factor you would derive would be lower. It's very hard to really get a good handle independently on what the field strength and the filling factor are when you have moderate broadening. And this is a comparison star, HR753, which is also the same spectral type, but is inactive, shows no chromospheric or coronal emission, and the same iron line we fit is fit fairly well by our zero field model. We again find a very narrow line profile there. When you move to M-dwarf, so you do find cases where the field is incredibly strong, and that makes our life easy because we can actually just point to things and say, there's a field there. What I've shown here in the white histogram is the spectrum of EV Lacerta. It's a very well-known flare star with the spectral type of M4.5. That puts it down in the region where the star is fully convective. It has no inner radiative zone. There is no tachocline in the star. We have a fully convective star. And also shown are M-dwarfs of different spectral types. And all this garbage out here is titanium oxide, something that you have to deal with when you're dealing with M-dwarfs. And you can see that between this spectral type and this spectral type, the spectra bracket the titanium oxide very well, and it's at this iron line at 8468 that the sigma components, this line is a simple Zeeman triplet, they split out very obviously from the line center, and you can measure their field. First of all, this spectra was not taken in Stokes V. This is just a Stokes I spectrum. And in Stokes V, we have actually looked at this object in Stokes V. You see nothing because you have equal amounts of opposite of positive and negative field polarity. And so what we're seeing here is that's one important thing about the Zeeman broadening. It doesn't really care what the field orientation is, what the polarity is. You're measuring just the simple broadening of the line. Now what I can do is divide two of those spectra by one another. I divide the active star by the inactive star, and you can see the TIO divides out completely. It's only at this iron line, and actually the titanium line, which is right next to it. This sucker here is also magnetically sensitive. All the molecules divide out, and what you're left with is the signature of the magnetic field from the star. One of the reasons that we had to do this division instead of modeling the spectra, the TIO, including the TIO, is it turns out TIO is a complicated molecule and nobody really knows what the wavelengths of its lines are, and so you can't synthesize a spectrum accurately of titanium oxide and fit a star. So a couple of things that are shown here. This is the division of the active star and the inactive star and a model fit to that division, and you can see we have purposely chosen to fit the core and the depth of these parts of the sigma component sticking out here, but the star obviously shows much broader absorption in its sigma components, and that's indicative of higher field strengths, that there is in fact a distribution of magnetic field on this star, not one single field value. If you do the fit as we've done here, you find a field strength of 3.8 kilogauss covering 60% of the star. Yes?
So solar
kind of a lot. Okay. Thank you. The point I mentioned before is we've assumed when we do this that the field is, or that the field regions are identical in atmospheric structure to the quiet regions. Are they spots? Are they plage? Is a legitimate question. And in fact, this field strength you derive is stronger than you would get if you do convective collapse calculations a la Sproutens-Weibull for an M-dwarf. The maximum field strength you would expect in a plage-like region, a thin flux tube on an M-dwarf, turns out to be pretty low, on the order of 800 gauss. We're measuring 3.8 kilogauss, and if you wanted to fit this stuff out here, you would need field strengths all the way up to 6 or 7 or 8 kilogauss to fit the entire wings. And so the question is, well, maybe are you actually looking at a spot? Maybe there's so much spot coverage on this star that you're looking at a spot and you have to deal with the Wilson depression and stuff like that. Yes? This thing here? That's the Lande G value?
Why it's not integer? What's effective?
The effective G is what the transition looks like. So you have a G associated with the upper state, a G associated with the lower state, and it's the actual transitions to form the absorption line that determine what the final G value is for the spectral line. And in the case of this titanium line, another reason you put G effective in there is because this, it turns out, is not a simple Zeeman triplet. It has about 18 Zeeman components. And so you can average over those and treat it as if it were a triplet. We've actually done the radiative transfer with all 18 components. We didn't do any of that averaging. And it turns out, and this guy again is just a simple triplet.
Now,
um, from probably in the K's, K7, it's probably the latest one where you see good evidence of a spot from Zeeman Doppler imaging, or just Doppler imaging without the Zeeman part to it. If you ask the question, okay, if maybe this is a spot, it turns out the real filling factor is related to the measured filling factor by this equation, where alpha is the flux ratio between the spot region and the quiet region. And if you assume that a spot on a M3 star, M4 star is maybe 1,000 Kelvin cooler than the quiet, if you put all these numbers in, you find out the filling factor would go up to 90%. So you're talking about, if it isn't a spot field, you already have a filling factor of 60%. If it is a spot field, it may even be as high as 90%. And so it's not really a spot. It's a star with a little bright point on it. we've looked at a number of M dwarfs now, and some earlier and some later. So some of them straddle that fully convective line. And they all show, the active ones, the flare stars, all show very strong fields, again, with filling factors of order 60% if you do this type of analysis. So what are some of the lessons we've learned from the M dwarfs? Well, they have very strong, again, greater than the convective collapse fields covering nearly the entire surface on these fully convective stars. Is there a rotational dependence similar to that rotation activity diagram that I showed at the beginning of the talk? Well, yes and no. No, in the sense that on any star that you can measure a field for, you don't see any dependence on its rotation rate. When you look at when other people like Suzanne Hawley and Neil Reed and her collaborators go out and measure the H-alpha strength of an M-dwarf and try and correlate that with V sine I, which is a measurement of its rotation, they see absolutely no correlation. However, all these stars that we measure the fields on that show these emissions are rotating at some level. The inactive stars have virtually no rotation. They have no measurable rotation at all. So at least it seems like in the M-dwarfs, you have sort of an on-off switch. If you're rotating a little bit, you get covered with field. If you're not rotating, you have no field. How about long-term behavior? We've looked at several of these M-dwarfs over rotational time scales, a few days each, looking every night for a few days. We've looked at them every few months, and then over the course of about 4 years. And we've seen no variation in the magnetic parameters on these stars. Even though we might not have the numbers exactly right, particularly the filling factor because of this uncertainty, if we just look for changes in the line profile from one observation to the next, we've never seen any changes. And so that means that the magnetic parameters are constant to about the 5% level once you factor in our noise. Another region thing I want to talk about a little bit is T Tauri stars, just because I've done a lot of work on T Tauri stars, particularly on their magnetic fields. And T Tauri stars are sort of important in the general context, because these are what the Sun used to be like when it was very young. T Tauri stars are solar mass stars that are only a few million years old, and they still have disks of material around them. And for many reasons, people believe that there are very strong dipole-like magnetic fields that actually lock to the disk. I won't go into exactly why people believe that, those are some of the motivations. And so what we've done with the T Tauri stars is we've gone out now to 2 microns, where the Zeeman sensitivity of titanium lines is very strong. It turns out when you go out to 2 microns, basically all the atomic lines that you can see are magnetically sensitive, and you have no magnetically insensitive diagnostics, except there are some CO lines out there in the same region, which have no Zeeman signature. And this is a spectrum of a K7 dwarf, a couple of K7 dwarfs that are known to be inactive, and they show very narrow both titanium and CO lines. When you start looking at some of these T Tauri stars, they show very broad titanium lines, the ones that are magnetically sensitive, and again, the CO lines remain very narrow in the spectrum. Again, these are Stokes I spectra, these are not V. And shown in the yellow is, again, a zero field model, Shown in the red is a distribution of field strengths. Again, no single field strength will fit these data. You have to have a distribution. But our resolution is not so great. So we've chosen 0, 2, 4, 6, and 8 kilogauss fields, just thrown them out there and said, what filling factor of each of those components do we need to fit the data? And this is what that distribution looks like. So you can see only about 20% of the star appears to have no field on it. But again, if you play that saying, maybe you're seeing a spot, that filling factor goes up to 90%. And this is a very common occurrence for T Tauri stars. Here's just another star, BP Tau. The first one was PW Haia. And just in this game, people have worried about whether or not you're seeing lines forming an accretion disk and have been concerned about that. Well, Hubble 4 is a T Tauri star that doesn't have an accretion disk. It's lost its disk for whatever reason. And we see the same trend. We see very broad titanium lines, relatively narrow CO lines, and we fit a magnetic field. If you take this field strength and multiply by this filling factor, you can add it up and you get a mean field, and they all come out to be about 2.5 kilogauss or so. Again, I said earlier that if the fields, at least on the T Tauri stars, appear in spots, the filling factor that you would then derive would be 90%. And people have done Doppler imaging on T Tauri stars. This is one example, SZ68. And you typically derive, as you do on all rapidly rotating stars, these polar spots, these large polar spots sitting at the rotation pole. But that's not covering 90% of the stellar surface. That's covering only 10% or so of the visible stellar surface. And so I think we can't really can't escape the fact that we're seeing fields basically all over the surface of the star. They're not confined to spots. They're not confined necessarily to plage, but they're basically all over the surface of the star. One of the things that I think is important to keep note about the T Tauri stars, these are also, because of their youth, they're on Hayashi tracks, they're fully convective. So they're not, again, there's no tachocline in these stars. They don't have an interface that you can deal with to drive your dynamo. 2 minutes? Okay, I will skip this. We have looked in Stokes V at the T Tauri stars as well as at the M dwarfs. And if you go back to this idea, to make this whole thing be in equilibrium, if you have an accretion disk where material is trying to fall onto the star, people have said, okay, you need a dipolar field to make that work. A dipolar field will produce a wavelength shift between a line seen in right and left circularly polarized light. This is taking the best model for BP Tau. This is what we should have seen, but this is what we saw. We saw no wavelength shift in any of our magnetically sensitive lines. So the fields, even though these stars, both the M dwarfs and the T Tauri stars, are covered with magnetic field, it is not a globally organized field. It's solar-like in the sense that you have lots of positive and negative polarity canceling out in any Stokes V signal. No, I said the theorists wanted a dipole. And I said it's not. This is just a little bit about Zeeman Doppler imaging, which I will quickly skip over except show you sort of the final picture. The group that Jean-François Donati and his collaborators, basically they take many lines, 1,000 lines, and basically add all that signal together and try to measure the polarization within within this averaged line profile. And shown here is a field that they get, the radial field that they derive when they do this as a function of rotational phase for this particular star. And the way they do that, or the way this can work, is when you have very rapid rotation, a spectral line gets very broad, and each individual part of that spectral line maps to a particular latitude on the star. And so even though the net field might be zero, you might expect complete cancellation if you were looking at a slowly rotating star. The fact that you smear all that out allows you to resolve some of these magnetic components. And they get field strengths in these regions up to a little over plus or minus 500 Gauss. But again, there's still some cancellation. The field actually at the surface is most likely stronger than that. But this is what they can measure. And there will be more observations of this type coming along. And I guess since I'm out of time, I'll stop there.
So, there are two questions. The first one, are they green? When you derive them, you assume the same brightness?
Yes.
In the Manhattan areas?
Yes. And so if it's a facular region, if it's brighter, the filling factors will go down. If it's a spot region, the filling factors go up.
Right.
That's the way it works out. And so, but facular regions, it's 60% if you assume it's the same. I don't think that the facular are more than they're not a factor of two brighter at these wavelengths than the quiet region. So I don't think you're going to get filling factors lower than 40%, 30 or 40%.
But you have a lot of lines.
Yes. You can in general. The problem with that is when you're working out in the infrared where the Zeeman sensitivity is very high, spectrographs or infrared detectors are small. They don't cover much of the spectrum, and so you get like two lines at a time. Those spectra that I was showing you that had the titanium lines and then the CO lines, that's four different settings, each observation taking several hours, and so it's impractical. Now in the optical, where the Zeeman sensitivity is low, a shell spectra are good, and you can cover virtually the entire optical spectrum in one shot. And so you do have things like TIO that you can look for, and that's another reason I didn't go into it, but that's another reason why we don't think that there are spot lines. We don't think they're spot fields because we don't see strong TIO. As far as are they brighter regions, we don't see obvious signatures that they're that much brighter, but if you really want to do it right, you need to isolate, say, the Zeeman sigma components, which you know are only coming from the magnetic region, and in the optical, we just don't have the sensitivity, the Zeeman sensitivity, to do that.
The other part of this is, if this is real, then I just want to interpret spectral paths, because this must have a major influence on the...
Well, and that's one of the things we, as observers doing this work, need. We need good models of what a stellar atmosphere immersed in a magnetic field would look like, so we can do our radiative transfer. What we do is we take Kurutz's models or the next generation models of Allard and Hauschild, and we just impose a magnetic field on that structure to do the radiative transfer. So that we've ignored the feedback of the field on the atmospheric structure.
It might be important to remember that in M-wars, convection is efficient out through the photosphere, and therefore it's a completely different situation in the sun.
Mm-hmm.
The sun convection just drops out in the photosphere, and therefore it's very easy to cool the interior of a transport, for example.
Right.
Whereas in an M-war, even if you reduce the efficiency in a sun in a star spot, it might still be about the same temperature.
That's one thing that I would like to pursue is these field strengths and these filling factors would in fact suppress convection at the visible photosphere of the star. And in principle, you might be able to detect that by looking at line asymmetries and that sort of thing. However, most of the people who've done work on line asymmetries have only gone out to K-ish, late K spectral types, because the M-dwarfs get messy with all that titanium oxide. You get line blends, and then measuring line asymmetries becomes more difficult to do. It's something that I think we can do and we should do, but hadn't been done yet.
Back at the beginning of your talk, you talked about correlation between rising or falling activity level,
mm-hmm.
rotation, current rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought you were implying what you'd like to tell me. Treating the sun as a star, in the early part of the cycle, you're going to see rotation rate decreasing with activity.
Right.
In the late part of the same cycle, you're going to see the opposite. Is that what you're seeing as a star?
No, they don't see the same star due the two different things. They see different stars doing different things. And people have looked at the sun as a star in these calcium H&K measurements, and they typically only see the rotation rate increasing as the cycle goes on. The signal isn't strong enough to see the opposite effect on the declining phase. Now, it's important to note that when they do the sun as a star and they try and fit a model to determine the differential rotation, they get the wrong number. They get the right sense, but they get the wrong number.
By how much?
50%, but don't quote me on that. It's
mm-hmm. Most of my favorite standard is color observation. But one of the things that I need to know is how the characteristic separation between gaps of polarities on solar surface varies from star to star. In other words, how the attribution size depends on, say, color radius or some other parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can get that from direct observation.
I think that's promising. The Zeeman Doppler imaging, while I think it's a great first attempt, but one of the things they do, when we asked earlier about how the different lines have different Zeeman patterns, some of them are really gross and some of them are only simple triplets, they assume everything is a simple triplet and they average everything together instead of fitting the individual line. So I'm not sure it's giving you an exact picture of what the stellar surface looks like. There are certainly real features there that they see, but the exact picture, I'm not so sure that's it. But another thing that one could do is, I think, looking at just the photometric variability. And you just, as active regions rotate on and off the surface of the star, you see the brightness change, and you might be able to get a handle on how big some of these active regions are from that sort of observation. I don't know how exact an answer you need, so I don't know if we can give you the answer yet.
Suppose you identify big Gauss spot in the star.
Mm-hmm.
Does it depend on the rotation? Because you know the rotation seems very slow.
Sure.
So it's real spot which appears up front and then go back.
I think you can do that in the Zeeman Doppler imaging. And so I'll show you. This is the, this is the spot map. Okay, so this is just where the spots are. And so you have in the black regions, that's actually should be white. There's no spots there. And up here at the pole, you get a nice polar spot. And so over here, you have a fairly large, perhaps spot-like structure, and there's no magnetic field there. So they don't map necessarily to exactly the same place. Now you do see.
Where is the repetition?
The repetition is here. This is the raw data. And you see these things. This is velocity in the line profile. This is rotational phase. And these are the things moving through the line profile. So this is the raw data that you take to invert and get these maps of the surface structure. And so they certainly do repeat. But this is just, I mean, this is one rotation. So there's no repetition here. This is just a surface map.
You said that for the Stokes V was actually very small.
Stokes V is.
Magnetic field is still strong. Does this mean that in the M dwarfs there's a drop in large scale magnetic field amplitude relative to the small scale field?
I think there must be the one thing that I think that would argue against that, or that you have to keep in mind, is when people do studies of flares on M dwarfs and you do radio observations, you can get a measure of the polarization of the radio signal. And if it was oppositely directed field lines, you would get one polarity, and if it was you'd get one radio sense of circular polarization. If it was the other sense, you'd get the other. When they look at some of these flare stars, they always see the same sense of polarity during a flare, as if there is only large-scale magnetic field that's being annihilated during a flare.
But that's because when you look at the corona, all the small scales that disappear is just the way it works.
Yes, but is the reconnection always happening? I mean, even when the small-scale stuff reconnects, you get a flare.
I think
because it smaller dipole moments, so it's more like nuclear moments.
Yeah, so even the violent nuclear, the field is still close enough to
right. Sure, but if you were looking in the northern hemisphere and you saw a flare, and you look in the southern hemisphere and saw a flare, wouldn't you see the opposite radial polarity from that flare, just because the you know, one's positive to negative, one's negative to positive. So it changes in the two hemispheres, and they never see that change on an M-dwarf during a flare.
It's very hard to observe radial
flares. Well, not on M-dwarfs. M-dwarfs, they don't. I mean, M-dwarfs, easy to see flares just because the star itself is so faint.
Years ago, they tried. I don't know what's happened recently.
Well.
Never getting it through the
light. So, where
you get it, what's
the correlation? Yeah, I think more recently there is good correlation with these on the M-dwarfs.
I had a question regarding the force. What's the feeling within the community as it, how reliable the inversions are in giving you these force, whether these are physically meaningful or some artifacts of the inversion?
When I got into the Doppler imaging game, I firmly believed they were artifacts of the, and then I actually did it and saw what you, and I think they're entirely real, and pretty much everybody I know who's actually done it thinks they're real, because it's very hard to produce a polar spot by having an inverted line profile as your basic line profiling. There are tricks you can play. Now, I should say, is it really a polar dark spot or a bright equatorial region? That, I don't think we can tell you, but there is certainly surface structure on the surface of the stars, and there's a polar thing and an equatorial thing. Well, it's not detected. Again, at the pole, you know, right at the rotation pole, you have no leeway in your Doppler signal, and so all that polarity cancels.
Okay. Well, let's thank Chris again.